Blog Talk Radio.
...of KJMA's practice of constructive community reporting, we have invited Dr. Khalid Mohammed, Minister and Supreme Captain of Minister Louis Farrakhan and the elite fruit of Islam, to help us to put today's events into perspective. Dr. Mohammed.
Thank you, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. The Honorable Elijah Mohammed and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan teach us that no matter how bad the condition looks that the black man and black woman is in, no matter how much self-destruction, no matter how much destructive behavior and conduct we see on the part of the black man and black woman, no matter how low the black man and black woman has fallen, the black man is the original man, God's people.
Could you help us to understand the kind of forces that create a Frank Williams?
When we look at a Roberta, a Frank Williams, and the many Frank Williams across the nation of America and the black nation in general, when we look at a Frank Williams, we see one who is other than self. And when we see him doing evil, we see him doing evil which is learned behavior, learned and picked up from the very devil himself over the past 400 years. I guess, Roberta, we could say the devil made him do it.
All right, black power, black power, black power to my people. We are back, and we are once again thankful for all of you who are switching right black over with us from the last. We don't want to waste any time. We just want to make sure we stretch out and have enough time to let our brother finish, as he was getting into some serious points with you, the listening audience, and those of you who have questions. So we don't want to cut our brother short at all. We don't want to cut you short. So we're back, Black Power Radio, live on air here Monday. Now, let me go right ahead and bring our national chairman back in so we can bring our guests back on. This is our national chairman, Minister Hashim Nzinga. Black Power, sir.
Brother, once again, we're privileged to be in Marcus Garvey whirlwind on this February that brings us the brothers like Frederick Douglass and the brothers like Dr. Collins and Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad, and then the DNA of the Frederick Douglasses. And as we will lighten up the airways with three-pointers and slam dunks, our brother is so humble and respectful. And we know how busy he is. We've been doing this 25 years. We clearly understand that we have to understand that when you can get a brother with wealth of knowledge like this, just the time that we need to give him to research, the time we need to give him to read the books, the time we need to give a professor to get ready to open a school, to teach, to save our youth, and on top of that, the speaking engagement, the travel time, and now so humble to give us this time. Brother Umar, we really appreciate it.
Well, the honor's all mine, my brother. The honor's all mine. I thank y'all for having me on.
You know, one thing I brought up, and then I'm going to turn you back over to Radio Land. I was bringing up the nature and the mentality of this system that we're caught up in. You know, I was so privileged to roll with Dr. Khalid Mohammed for many years, and he was my mentor, and I was his national assistant, and with Attorney Malik Zulu Shabazz, and which takes us to the same circle of people that you're in, Dr. Jeffries, and on and on. And one of the things we read, all of us read, was the book out of New York called The Invisible Man. They don't see us, and we were talking off the air about the biggest case of the century since O.J., since Rodney King, since the Rosewood, since Black Wall Street, with our young brother Trayvon Martin in Stanford, Florida. And I was saying, in the midst, when Asia, when Russia, when China, when Nigeria, when South Africa and the Bahamas, and the whole world was watching this Trayvon Martin story, shocked that a beast like Zimmerman would shoot a baby down in the middle of the day going to his house to watch the NBA All-Star game eating Skittles and drinking tea, and the whole world is watching Attorney General Eric Holder to see what would happen to this case. And down the street in Jacksonville, Florida, why this is still on our table, and you're a doctor, you're a psychologist, a white man walks up, pay for his gas, go back to the gas pump, looks into the car, some young African-American teenagers who doing what the white boys do with rock and roll and all what they do, listening to the rap music kind of loud. And he's so arrogant, he goes over and challenges them on the loudness of their music and shoots a 17-year-old child, Jordan Davis, to death. And then on the that's in Jacksonville, Florida, not even a good 200 miles from Stanford. And then another 200 miles from Stanford in Valdosta, they find Kendrick Johnson, 17, wrapped up in a mat, been beat to death. What can we do as human beings that went through Emmett Till, that went through the bombing, the four sisters, little girls at the church, that went through the Rosewoods, that went through the Megger Evers, that went through the Dr. Kings, that went through the Malcolm, shot down consistently, and in 2014, we still don't stand a chance?
Well, I tell you one thing about oppression, and we've seen this all throughout world history. Oppression tends to breed the revolutionary force necessary to destroy it. In other words, when you push a people up against the wall and you just keep on pushing and keep on pushing out of your interest to maintain your order of power, you actually end up creating the exact opposite. A level of reaction and energy that's going to tear down that oppressive system altogether. All behavior is a function of the consequences that follow. All behavior. This is the essence of behavioral psychology. All behavior is maintained or eliminated based off of what happens. I'm saying that to say that we as black folk collectively as African people have to look at how our indifference, our political indifference, maybe not our emotional indifference, emotionally we were upset with what happened to Trayvon and all of our other brothers, but politically and economically there was no pushback from the black community, not in a significant measurable way. So we have to recognize that our silence or inaction, not necessarily our silence because we're pretty vocal, but our inaction reinforces the likelihood that more children are going to be murdered because behavior is maintained by the consequences. So the black community has to look at how when a tragedy happens like Trayvon, what we do or don't do is automatically going to increase or decrease the likelihood that it's going to happen again. We also have to look at the role of the media, the mainstream media, who is very clever at letting white people know what the government is willing to let them do to African people. See, when you saw the Trayvon murder and when I saw the Trayvon murder, we were hurt. That's our brother. Police brutality, another young child slain. But when a white person sees Trayvon, when a white person sees Reginald Denny, when a white person sees Rodney King, when a white person sees all those other brothers, the message is being sent to them in a very Machiavellian way that it's okay to kill these people. See, media helps to shape public behavior. There's been studies that show the more you show violence on TV, the more violence will exist in the community because what you are doing is conditioning the unconscious of your viewing audience into the behaviors you want them to actually enact. So the more police brutality shown on TV, the more police brutality you're going to get. And the more murders of black children shown on TV, the more murders you're going to get. That doesn't mean they should stop showing them because we need to know what's going on. But I want the listening audience to be crystal clear that the media shows that the media actually has two functions, one to inform and the other to condition and forewarn white people.
The psychological thing is so deep, I want to take you somewhere right quick that I think you would like to go. I've studied your ancestor, our big brother Frederick Douglass, extensively. One of the shocking things that I found in his books and his writings was when the abolitionaries, all of them, worked so hard to get him in a position they were thinking to free him, which means, you know, he was more of a man than all of them. But the psychological thing is when they choose to think they can free a black man who made them with their sick butts. And in his books, let me stick with the topic matter. In his books, he went to England. He wrote the book. He went to England. He was treated well in England. He say he saw a whole different world in Europe that he didn't see here. And then he published his book, and they were telling him not to come back because he would be killed if he come back because of his book, or captured because he was still a slave. And he was such a great, honorable man that he was like, straight up, I didn't do what I've done to run from the plight of my people. I have done what I have done to help save my people. I got to come back to America and be among my people. And then I started to read how they didn't want him to do certain things. They wanted to control him. And in the end, he fell out with a bunch of them because they wanted to control him and they wanted him to stay weak and just stay with the program that they were writing. But he really fought teeth and nail against a bunch of the abolitionists, the writers of his time. And then he started to, the North Star and started to outright them. And we know the rest of the history. But talk about that somewhat psychologically, that a people will try to set up an underground railroad and act to help you. But when you get free and smarter than them, they want to control you, and then you have to fall away from them.
Well, what you just discussed, my brother, who is one of the first, I believe, excellent examples of how the white liberal is one of the greatest white racists that there is. William Lloyd Garrison was the culprit, so-called father of the American anti-slavery movement, which he started in the 1830s, the organization. So anyway, after Uncle Frederick escapes from slavery to freedom, he meets up with William Lloyd Garrison. They hear him speak. And then he says, well, I want to hire you to be a speaker on the anti-slavery platform. So Douglass agreed, of course, to help my people. But Douglass began to want to articulate the political platform to bring about the end of enslavement. That's when the fallout happened. Garrison only wanted Frederick to talk about life as a slave. He did not want him intellectualizing the anti-slavery movement. In other words, he just wanted to use him as the circus clown who was once enslaved, and then after he talked about how his life was as a slave, then he will come and intellectualize the anti-slavery platform. So Frederick said, I can do that myself, and who better to do it than a member of the oppressed group? But Garrison said, that's not your place. And once Douglass made it clear to him that I'm going to do things the way that I want to do them, what did William Lloyd Garrison start doing? He started openly attacking Frederick Douglass in his newspaper. When Frederick Douglass started the North Star with the grandfather of Pan-African nationalism, Martin Delaney, William Lloyd Garrison got upset with him and did not give him his blessing because he only wanted Douglass to write for the Liberator, his paper. So you see how this so-called liberal who's fighting to free blacks didn't want to give Frederick Douglass his own political and ideological freedom to argue his own position on ending slavery and to put out his own newspaper. This is how hypocritical the white liberal is. And then when slavery was over, so-called, after the 13th Amendment was passed, Douglass goes to Garrison. Now, this is 30 years later. This started in 1830. Remember, he escaped from slavery to freedom in 1828. So now we're talking 1865. This is almost 40 years later, both of them up in age. Douglass goes to Garrison and says, I heard you're about to disband the American anti-slavery movement. I don't understand how you're disbanding the movement. And Garrison told Douglass, because you people are free. And Douglas said, but my people still don't have the right to vote. They still don't have education. They still don't have jobs. They're still not free from Ku Klux Klan terrorism. You can't eliminate the American Anti-Slavery Society until black people have been thoroughly integrated into the body politic and have achieved equality. And guess what Douglas, guess what Garrison says in so many words? And I want the listening audience to hear this. He basically told Douglas, I did not fight against slavery to make you equal to me. I only fought against slavery because I thought it was wrong and that you had a right to be free, not to be equal. And that is the message we have to understand about the white liberal. He might fight against police brutality. He might fight for your right to vote. He might fight against poverty. He might fight against educational racism. But understand something. Never confuse the white liberal's fight with an unconditional belief in equality of the races. The white liberal is still a white supremacist and still considers himself better than you.
Wow. Brother Sean? Boy, God is the greatest. Brother Sean, do we got some callers?
Oh, yes, sir. They on.
You They're already on. Know me and brother go all night because I got all the books right here, and I've been waiting, but I call them in private and ask most of these questions. Go ahead and let our listeners enjoy our genius that God has blessed us with.
All right. Welcome back, callers. Again, the number to call is 646-478-4447. We'll go right to it. The area code here is 845-787. Area code 845-33-787. You're on live with Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, Black Power Radio. And your host, talk to us. Your question, comment, Black Power. Welcome.
Hello, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I just learned that of your station from Mr. Johnson from Twitter. I'm Jesus is a Black Man. I just got a question. What makes you think that black people was more, what's the reason why you think black people was more, had more business mind during the Harlem Renaissance, the Oklahoma, Black Wall Street, compared to today, even though today we had no more about history, about the Moors, about the ancient Egyptians, about Jesus being black, and et cetera. Mr. Johnson, sir.
Excellent question. Number one, the reason why we had so many Black Wall Street, I was just at one the other day, Durham, North Carolina, Rosewood, Florida, Wilmington, Charleston, South Carolina. We had Black Wall Streets, Tulsa, all over the country. But you have to understand the context in which those Black Wall Streets emerged. They emerged under the context of forced segregation. Black people did well because they had no choice. We were forced to do for self. And so you hear a lot of brothers and sisters now say, well, you know what? They, i.e. the white man, they need to resegregate us again. Well, I have a problem with the wording. Why does your oppressor have to force you to do what is in your own best interest? See, segregation forced us to teach our own children, forced us to build our own infrastructure. And what has to be understood about a lot of those Black Wall Street, not all of them, but several, when you do your research, you're going to find out what? After the Europeans came in and burned those communities down, they built them back up. They built them back up. The black people came back home and built them back up. But something happened. Integration happened. And that meant that the children of those who built those communities no longer valued independent African institutions and business. See, the white man said, I can come and be a part of his hospital. I don't need my own. The white man said, I can come and work at his school. I don't need my own. A lot of those communities were not abandoned by the black folk. They still owned that property. They came back and built, but when they passed it off to the next generation, the children and grandchildren did not value determination. And so they sold the properties away. That's what happened to a lot of the Black Wall Street. Yeah, the white folks burned them down. But that didn't end it. It's when the next generation did not value what their parents had built and simply walked away from it. And that's our problem now. we are so in love with white folks. Remember, there was never an integration movement in America. Never. There has only been a desegregation movement. You have to understand the difference between the two. Integration means I am going to intently integrate you into the American social order. I'm going to force the schools to take you. I'm going to force the hospitals to take you. I'm going to force. That's integration. You've never really had integration in America. You had deseg. Desegregation means what? I'm going to remove all physical barriers to your integration. But it doesn't mean that I'm going to integrate you. See, this is where a lot of us get hung up at. They desegged us. They never integrated us. They deseg. So they removed the barriers away, but they never integrated. Public school is just as segregated today as it was in 1954 because there was never an integration movement for the schools. There was only a deseg. So we're just going to remove the barrier, but we're not going to do anything to guarantee the opportunity. This is the game the white man plays to give you the illusion of progress, the illusion of inclusion. We have to be able to see through the tricks. What did Nili Fuller tell us about white supremacy? That great elder master teacher, he said what? They establish white supremacy. They maintain it. They expand it. And then they refine it. We are in the stage of refinement. Slavery was the stage of establishment. In slavery, the white racism was overt. It was brutal. It was expressed. It was aggressive. It was violent. But here we are 400 years later. It's more sophisticated. They don't have to do none of that anymore because the racism is now codified into the law. The racism is codified into the law. Let me give you an example. You are a construction worker, and you heard the city is taking bids on a new mall that they're going to build downtown in your city. This is a public project. So they have to open it up for bids for any construction agency who wants to bid on building this new mall for the sake of the city. So you go, as a black man, I would like to bid on building this mall. And they say, I'm sorry, you cannot. And you say, well, what do you mean I cannot? Because I'm black? They say, no. In order to bid on this project, you have to have a $2 million construction bond. Do you have a $2 million construction bond? No, I do not. Well, you can't bid. That's race. No, it's not race. These are just the rules that we have created. And if you cannot follow the rules, you cannot bid. But it is totally racist. Why? The reason you ain't got a $2 million bond is because you can't get access to capital in the banks because the banks are redlining black people, and white people know this. So what they do is they put the racism in the rules. They put the racism in the laws. They put the racism in a protocol. They put the racism in the structure. Like me and Brother Hashim was speaking earlier, 95% of all criminal cases are plea bargained. Now, you go to the judge and you say, well, I was sent to jail for a crime I didn't commit for 20 years. And the judge says, well, you chose to plea bargain. You could have went to trial. And you say the reason I plea bargain is because I could not afford a lawyer. And why can't you afford a lawyer? Because you don't make enough money to hire a lawyer. And why don't you make enough money to hire a lawyer? Because the American social order, economic order is racist and keeps black men unemployed. That's why you couldn't hire a lawyer, which led to you plea bargaining, which led to you spending 20 years in jail for a crime you didn't commit. They'll say you made a decision to plea bargain. You didn't make no damn decision. You had to look at the situation in which you existed and the fact you had no resources because white supremacy doesn't allow us to amass capital, and that's how you ended up in jail. It was still racism, but because it's hiding behind the laws and the rules and the regulations, it looks like authority when it's nothing but racism.
Right. Then ask the brother's question. Can y'all hear me? Yes. Can y'all hear me? Y'all still on?
Yes, I can.
Okay, just want to make sure that you can lose. You hope that answers brother's question here. Black man, did I answer your question?
Yeah, you speaking to me? Oh, hello.
Yes, sir.
Hello?
Yes, sir. You're on live. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, he did. I mean, Mr. Johnson is a credible speaker, and I really respect his work. Hopefully I get to see him in the Black. I first saw him do Black Authority on YouTube when he's going to do a documentary on Black people, you know, building an economy. I'm building, building finance in the community.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We appreciate your question. We're going to move forward and take some more calls. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Your stream is not really live. I look at you through the phone call, so through the now I can't hear you on Blog Talk Radio, just to let you know.
I want to refresh. We on live. We on live on Blog Talk.
Because I'm trying to find a channel, but I couldn't. I guess I don't get a lot. But I'm just giving you a heads up. All right, peace.
We'll check it out. We'll check it out. Make sure we're coming through. We definitely on the air. We'll check it out. Just double check. Next call here, area code 216-965. 216-965, you're on live. This is Black Power Radio. You're talking to Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, the Prince of Pan-Africanism. Your question, your comment, please welcome in Black Power. Yes, sir. Go right ahead. You're on live. Your mic's open.
Yeah. Okay. With the situation with the Michael Sims, what's his opinion about that, the gay football player?
I need somebody to restate that question. I couldn't hear my brother well.
I think he was,
question one more
brother,
time,
I think
Carter.
He was talking about the college player who today came out and acknowledged that he's crazy as hell.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. You have to propagate the lifestyle if you want to be accepted. See, whenever you can get prominent blacks, remember now, the black athlete is considered the most masculine black man in this country. So if you can get a black football player who's the epitome of aggressive black masculinity to say he's homosexual, you are now able to effectively influence our young masculine boy athletes in high school to think it's okay to be gay, because they're now saying you can be gay and masculine. That's the whole message with that. With the basketball player and now the football player, they're letting our young people know you can still be masculine. You can still sag your pants. You can still have swagger. You can still gangster and be homosexual at the same time. All of this is propaganda. It's no coincidence that they're coming out at different times, because why are they doing this? White people already accept homosexuality. So why is this being done if white folks already accept it? These are black athletes. These are black athletes. They're trying to condition black people into accepting homosexuality. That's what all this is about. In other words, you get to the point that you have so many gay black people where you throw up your hands and you say, you know what, look, if you can't beat them, join them. And even though you're not going to practice it yourself, you will now see it as normal behavior. Same thing with interracial marriage. Enough brothers marry white women, you get so tied up, you say, well, maybe it's okay. In other words, you let the sheer number of a sick situation convince you to believe that it's no longer sick. See, I don't care how many black people become alcoholics, drug addicts. I don't care how many black men go to jail. It's not normal to me. I don't care how many women start sleeping with other women. It's not going to be normal to me. You're not going to change my mind. My mind is too strong for you to think you're going to change the way I think on any issue just because you keep on showing me people who represent the opposite position. We have to be headstrong when it comes to homosexuality. We got to be headstrong when it comes to white supremacy. We got to be headstrong when it comes to all these black bourgeoisies we got. Don't let them convince you to accept something you know is wrong just because so many people are practicing it. That's the definition of weakness. Strength is being able to be the only one in the room and saying, brothers and sisters, this is wrong. That is strength. But if you're going to adjust your opinion to the dominant ideology of the time, then you're just a follower. You ain't no leader, and you damn sure ain't no independent thinker going along with the get-along. We got to resist this propaganda campaign That's designed to convince us all that there's nothing we can do about the homosexual onslaught that's taking place against our young people.
That's right.
Is he still on, Brother Sean?
Yes, sir. Call it to answer your question.
Yeah. Hey, brother, I'm so glad you handled that, doctor and professor, because to see a middle linebacker, when I see a middle linebacker, I think about Lawrence Taylor. I think about him breaking Joe Namath's leg and hearing it snap. I think about so many great middle linebackers. I think of Hollywood Henderson, who wouldn't shut up. I think about so many who went before in the 60s breaking into this pro football, and even though, you know, we know the psychology of that, but I just think at least those men were man. Now, first the pro basketball player, he's highlighted by the President of the United States. Now, these crackers, all Fox, CNN, all these news stations are carrying this, and they love it because, like you said, they're breaking down the black man to the least common denominator. They saying, nigga, we could take your middle linebacker who's cracking people back and make him say he's gay.
Right.
And, you know, this is sick. Brother Sean, go ahead, because you know I go all day on that. Brother, let's let this brother keep blessing our people.
All right. All right. We're going to roll. Next call here, your area code is 816-325. 816-325. You're on live with Black Power Radio. And your host, this is Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Give us your question or your comment. Come on with it, Black Power.
All right, Black Power Brothers. Dr. Johnson, I got two quick questions for you. First one is, when are you coming back to Kansas City, Missouri? And number two, what is your thoughts about repatriation back to Africa?
Excellent. First question, when am I coming back to Kansas City, Missouri? I'm scheduled to be in St. Louis on Saturday, April the 12th. And what I'm probably going to do is get in contact with my connections in St. Louis with the African Village and the National Black United Fund, because they've been working with me and Team Pan-African. We're organizing an independent black parent association in both sides of Kansas City, the Missouri side as well as the Kansas side. And, in fact, Sister Tashia, she texted me tonight to let me know that they've already had their first meeting on both sides of Kansas City. So I was very happy to hear that they were already moving on it without me even having to tell them. So I need to come back to help further with the structure and organization of that. So I'm going to see to make sure everything's solidified with St. Louis, and if that be the case, I'm going to look to come over to Kansas City maybe that Sunday and Monday following the St. Louis program to further help organize this new Kansas City Independent Black Parent Association. So it should be April. It should be April, and it probably will be the weekend of the 12th. As far as repatriation, I think that that is something that we really need to start looking at. It's going to be hard to truly practice black nationalism when you're not in a black land. And I definitely understand and support my Moorish brothers who definitely stand on the square that this is our land. I totally agree with them on that. But politically and strategically speaking, I think that the high ground that needs to be fought for is the original ground and the richest ground. Africa is the most minerally rich continent on the face of the earth. I cannot fight to keep America when I know that I have something that's much more valuable. So for me and Pan-Africanism, our thing is take the high ground first. In military, what do they teach you? Take the high ground first and then take the lower ground. Africa is the high ground. America and all these other continents is the low ground. Let us get the high ground first. And once you have the high ground, securing the low grounds will be a whole lot easier. It amazes me how many black folk make excuses up for why we cannot repatriate. Do you realize Africans have been repatriating back home since the first day we got here during the Great Maafa? Sierra Leone was built by Africans who decided to go back home. Liberia built by Africans who decided to go back home. So all throughout our history, we've been going back. Before Marcus Garvey, Martin Delaney took Africans back home. Okay, we had all types of repatriationists who helped Africans get back home. And the idea isn't to just move back home and live happily ever after. That's not the idea.
The idea is we have to have a pan-African presence everywhere on earth. Just like every other country is represented globally, we have to be represented globally. So, yes, we, like Mr. Garvey said, everybody doesn't go back to Africa. There was never a back-to-Africa movement. The media made that up. Mr. Garvey was very clear. Only those who were industrial enough to go to Africa as trailblazers to help build up the infrastructure. If you're a lazy Negro in America, you're going to be a lazy Negro back home, and Africa got enough problems of its own. It don't need us coming with our problems. They don't need to see black men getting off no ship with their white wife. They don't need to see no black woman getting off no ship with no blind weed. They don't need to see no black boy with a basketball and a football. They don't need to see homosexual couples coming out. They don't need to see that filth. You see, so everybody can't go back to Africa, but for those like yourself and myself who clearly have a spiritual and a political economic investment in the continent, we do need to go back and help build up Africa, because as she goes, so goes the rest of us. See, that's the foundation of Pan-Africanism. You cannot do better than the motherland. I don't care if you are Russian. I don't care if you Chinese. I don't care if you East Indian, Korean. Wherever you come from, you have never seen a people outside of the homeland get more respect than the homeland itself. We are forever chained to Africa's reputation. We are forever chained to Africa's reputation. So as far as repatriation go, and I know my Bobo Shanti Rastafari brothers who are like family to me as well, just like my new Black Panther Party brothers, they know that we got to go back and have a stake in Africa. We cannot ignore Africa and just let the Chinese man come and rob it blind. Let the white man come and rob it blind. Why is white supremacy king? Why is white supremacy king? Because it controls Africa's resources. Why is China king? Because China is controlling Africa's resources. And here we are, control none of the resources in Africa and don't even want to be interested in the conversation, because we've been taught, like Brother Malcolm said, to hate the root. And you can't hate the root without hating the tree. But let me say this in closing to the question. Dr. Umar Johnson will be leading my first trip back home to Africa. This won't be my first time over there, but this will be my first group trip. So if you've never been to the Mother Continent, or even if you've been to the Mother Continent and you want to go back with Dr. Umar Johnson, we're going to be going right now. The dates appear to be July 14th through the 24th. I'm actually meeting with my Ghanaian host tomorrow morning before she flies back over to Ghana, where she just repatriated from New Jersey to Ghana. She lives there full time now, and she just moved back. So I don't want to hear nobody talking about we can't go to Africa, it's too hard over there, da-da-da-da. Here's a sister working on her doctorate degree, so-called middle-class black woman, doing quite well for herself in New Jersey, but she said, uh-uh, this ain't home. And now she's living in Ghana and doing better in Ghana than she was doing in America, and she was quite fine in America. So tomorrow we're going to sit down, go over the whole trip, and she's going to get on the plane. I'm dropping her off at the airport. She's going to get herself back to Ghana and set everything up on that side of the water. July 14th through the 24th, I'm calling it Dr. Umar's Psycho-Spiritual Reconstruction Tour. We're going to go to the El Mina Slave Dungeon. We're going to go to Cape Coast Slave Dungeon. When you get off the plane, there's going to be a re-Africanization ceremony. You're going to have to take your shoes off and go through the water. There's going to be an ancestral bath that you're going to have to take. We're going to go to the W.E.B. Du Bois Center and the Nkrumah Center. There's going to be a pre-Earth Day celebration for Dr. Nkrumah, whose Earth Day is in September, but we're going to celebrate it early on in July. And then we're going to go to Kumasi. We're going to go up into the villages of the Akan so you can witness a real firsthand African spiritual ceremony where they invoke the ancestors and the deities and sacrifice the animals to, in the name of the Most High. This is going to be a psycho-spiritual trip. If you don't want your Willie Lynch chip deactivated, you do not want to go on this trip, because everything you thought you knew was wrong. We're going to break you down and build you right back up in 10 days in Ghana. The trip is going to be powerful, brothers and sisters. And if you're interested in going, then I should have the information on my Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, hopefully by March the 1st. Okay, I'm going to keep the trip as cheap as possible because I know a lot of us don't have it like that. Okay, so I want to keep it basic. I told her I'm not trying to make any money off this trip. As God and my ancestors is my witness, Dr. Umar isn't making a penny Now, the travel agent has to make money because he's in business. I understand that. But those prices better be acceptable, especially when this is not a for-profit trip. So please mark your calendar. July 14th to 24th is going down in West Africa, Ghana, home of Pan-Africanism.
Man, that's strong. That's strong.
That's awesome.
All right, let me keep it moving. We're jam-packed here. Next caller here, your area code is 937-954. 937-954, you're on live. This is Black Power Radio. Umar Abdullah Johnson, come forward with your question, please. Welcome, Black Power.
Hello?
Yes, go right ahead. You're on live.
Yes, hello. My name is Muhammad Luwamba. Been following Dr. Umar for a long time, really agree with a lot of the stuff that the brother says, especially about Uganda and Liberia, because two points I wanted to make. My father and his side of the family are from Uganda, and my mother and her side of the family are from Liberia. So I've been to both countries, and the brother is right. The resources in Uganda and Liberia are immense, especially Liberia coming out of war right now. There's a lot of reconstruction going on, and according to my big brothers that live in Liberia right now, you can't even go to a hotel owned by Liberian. They're all owned by Chinese, and the few hotels owned by Liberians, the Chinese people that own hotels will pay Liberians that work in the hotel for when people call to book the room to say that there's no vacancy, so they'll go to the Chinese hotel. So there's a lot of resources in Africa and Uganda and Liberia right now that a lot of, unfortunately, our brothers aren't taking advantage of, and the Chinese and the Europeans are over there just basically raping the country. So that's my first point, and I want to get Dr. Umar's response on that. The second thing I want to talk to him about, and I chimed in late, so I don't know if you guys already talked about this, what do you think about the blatant homosexualizing of hip-hop music, specifically that happened at the Grammys? I remember when you were talking about what happens when you share power and how us sharing the power of hip-hop, now the main hip-hop rapper is a white guy that's promoting homosexuality with a song called Same Love, and 33 gay couples get married during his set, and none of these rappers that claim they so hard are always coming at other rappers' necks for selling a lot of records saying hip-hop is about competition, but none of these rappers is coming at this white boy that's trying to impose homosexuality into hip-hop, and I'm talking about this white boy named Macklemore with his whole homosexual agenda. So I just wanted to ask Dr. Umar what he thought about that.
Well, number one, the best way to condition the people is to control their music. You have never seen a people listen to derogatory mood music who did not entertain a derogatory estimation of themselves. Go back to the music that we listened to in the 60s. There was a black power theme to it. Go back to the music that we listened to in the 1980s with Eric B. and Rakim and KRS-One, okay, Big Daddy Kane. Okay, there was a consciousness in the community and a consciousness in the music at the same time. If you ever want to know what the level of consciousness is for any people, listen to their most popular music. Now, the one thing we know about art is that art reflects and it also influences. So, for example, music doesn't just reflect the state of the people. Music helps to create the state of the people. That's why when you hear people say Jay-Z changed the game, Jay-Z changed the way hip-hop is, Lil Wayne, 50 Cent, because art influences the people and the people influence the art. It's a bi-directional influence and relationship. It's not one or the other. Like some people will say, well, don't get mad at me for talking about drugs. I'm only talking about what I grew up living. Okay, I can understand that. But by you popularizing it, you're influencing other people to consider doing something that they would have never done because you keep on repeating it through the music. So a music with the people is like a man with his wife. They influence each other all day long. So by having Macklemore and others popularize homosexuality through their music, it goes right back to my earlier statement. What better way to push homosexuality than through an aggressive black male athlete? What better way to push homosexuality through hip-hop? Remember now, hip-hop is the purest expression of aggressive, militant black manhood. At least it was. If you wanted to find out what the young, black, radical, aggressive, militant brother thought, you go listen to rap. Look at it now. They're effeminizing hip-hop. So now, not only are they effeminizing hip-hop, as they effeminize hip-hop, they are glamorizing hip-hop. excuse me, they are glamorizing the effeminization of the hip-hop at the same time. And the reason why you don't see rappers speaking out against it, because the record labels that control all of them, okay, they get, see, remember, when you work for somebody, you get your regular meetings, you get your regular briefings, you get your emails, you get your publications, and you're told in no uncertain terms that you will not speak out against this because this is the way we're taking the music, because this is the direction in which society is going. Remember, the president and CEO of every major music house built a burger table. So they are at the table when AIDS is being discussed. They're at the table when population control is being discussed. They're at the table when the exploitation of Africa's resources is being discussed. They're at that planning table. So naturally, once they get their marching orders, they give those marching orders to their soldiers, the rappers and CEOs and A&Rs, and say, this is the direction we're going in. They're not going to tell you why hip-hop is going to be glamorizing homosexuality. But at that Bilderberg table, it was made clear. Because this is a very effective population control weapon. The more gay blacks you get, the less black children are born. So we have to understand what is being done. And we have to recognize and understand that it is never in our best interest to give our cultural products away to the oppressors. We should have never gave hip-hop away. We should have never gave jazz away. And you know what's happening now, brothers and sisters? We are now giving away African spirituality. We now have white men playing the drums at Kwanzaa ceremonies. White men beating the drums at Juneteenth celebrations. White men and women dancing in voodoo ceremonies. If y'all haven't been paying attention, white folks are now colonizing our African spiritual secrets. They're drumming. They're being initiated as priests. Initiated as priests. How in the hell can you have a European as an African priest of spirituality? How can you do that? How can you? But this is what's happening. We're selling all of our cultural products away to the enemy. We still haven't learned our lesson.
You're right about that, brother. You're right. Second thing on Uganda, in response to Barack Obama's trying to impose homosexuality on the continent of Africa with his homicidal agenda, the President Museveni of Uganda, where my dad's from, put in the Constitution that homosexuality is punishable by death, which started all this Uganda Be Kidding Me stuff on the liberal MSNBC that pretend to be friends of black people, the white liberals. What do you think about that? Do you think that that's just, and do you think that that's an appropriate response to Barack Obama trying to impose a homosexual agenda on the continent of Africa?
First of all, African people have been on this planet longer than anybody else. And I think it is quite arrogant and ignorant for a puppet, a Negro puppet, to go over to the world's oldest civilization. Not only is Africa the oldest continent, Uganda is home of the oldest civilization. That's where man was born. The birth of the Nile River. That's the oldest civilization on earth, older than Kemet. And you go to them and tell them that they have to reconstruct their definition of family? I'm totally against Obama going into Africa telling those heads of state how they're supposed to operate. Now, if you ask me whether or not Dr. Umar Johnson thinks that every single homosexual should be murdered, I cannot stand on that principle. And the reason I cannot stand on that principle wholesale is because many of our homosexual and lesbian brothers and sisters begin their lives as children. So if you're going to murder every homosexual and lesbian, ultimately you're going to have to kill children because many of them are brought into that life by molestation and incest.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and so by the time you even find out they're gay, they've already been practicing that lifestyle for a long time. So I'm not saying that I'm against it wholesale, but I don't endorse it wholesale either. I think there needs to be some room for the courts to interpret as to whether or not that type of a sentence needs to be pronounced. But I cannot advocate that wholesale because so many of our people end up sexually confused by virtue of trauma during their childhood. And so for me as a psychologist, I have to look at this thing holistically. I do not support it. I do not condone it. They may need to be institutionalized for the rest of their life, always under supervision, never around children, but a blanket law that kills everyone. I don't know if I can support that, but I'm not going to condemn it either because I have no right to tell our heads of state in Africa how to run those nations.
Brother Sean, is that it on that question? Brother Umar, you still with me, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, let me come closer to home. We got another caller. I'll let him come back on in a few minutes because we're almost going to run out of time again. Here in Atlanta, we got a situation. I lived in an area in Stone Mountain called a subdivision, nice subdivision because I work hard and I want my family to live right. In the subdivision I lived in, we got a CEO of DeKalb County. His name was Burrell Ellis. And on the other side of me, we had the president of the school board. We all lived in the same subdivision called Southland. The SWAT team came to Southland twice, surrounded the community. Everybody thought they was coming to get me, the national chief of staff of the New Black Panther Party at that time. But one time they came and they arrested and searched the home of the CEO of DeKalb County, Burrell Ellis. And the CEO of DeKalb County is the second richest black county in the United States. And the second time they came to arrest the president of the school board in DeKalb County. He's under indictment, and he went to court, and he took a plea to tell on some other people, and he's supposed to get 12 months probation. And the judge told him after he took the plea and told on the others, you get in handcuffs, too. Right in the courtroom, she changed her plea, handcuffed him, said, you're going to do some time, too. He had to bond out and take his plea back. Burrell Ellis went to court last week, the CEO of the second richest county, and he got 12 indictments. A black, by the way, a black DA named James is doing this, and now the DA is under the microscope. All I'm saying is this. While they're watching the revolutionaries stand up and think we were being attacked, they're attacking us across the board. In Atlanta,
yes,
and this is my point because I really want you to work with this. In Atlanta, the sister who ran one of the biggest school boards in the country in Atlanta, she was indicted. 126 mostly black teachers was indicted. They gave her like a $7 million bond and paraded her before the world as Bunny and Clyde. Then they reduced it, of course, to like some ridiculous amount, like $2,000. You start off at $7 million. But I think all of it's behind. Now they're trying to destroy the credibility that blacks can't run education or education institutions. And I want you, and that's happening right now as we speak. The Atlanta school board president is under indictment. The DeKalb school board president is under indictment. And I want you to tell me what are you thinking about that, and are you seeing that around the country?
Oh, yes. In fact, black politicians are less than, what, 10% of all politicians in this country, and yet they represent over 30% of those who are currently under investigation, who are being spied on, and who are under indictment. Without question, running for public office can be dangerous to your health as a black person. You see what happened to Kwame Kilpatrick, Jesse Jackson Jr. This is a national phenomenon to do what? Prevent blacks from taking office. That's why this is being done. Now, check this out. Many of the blacks who are under indictment were not even loyal to their own community. So this ain't about taking down revolutionary leaders. This is about reminding bourgeois Negroes that even though you have my doctorate degree, even though you're married to my daughter, even though you can walk like me, dress like me, talk like me, quote Aristotle and Plato like me, you still ain't white. See, what a white person can't stand more than anything else, more than you and me, is a black person who thinks that they don't know that they feel that they're better than them. They can't stand black folks who think they made it. They can't stand bourgeois who think that they're on the same level with them. Remember, the white man's burden under a white supremacist order is to always keep the distinction between himself and his oppressed people. It is a sin for the oppressed to ever think they're equal with the oppressor. And that's why black bourgeoisie, ironically, even though they fight to defend the white man, are also just as likely to be abused and arrested and incarcerated and sabotaged by the white man because you are closest to his status. The black bourgeois is closest to status with the white. And because of that, they put a little bit more emphasis on making sure there's a clear distinction between those who benefit from white privilege and those who suffer from white power. That's why those blacks are under investigation. How dare you think you got a right to be mayor? How dare you think you got a right to take this Senate spot from me? All black people are the enemy of white supremacy. Whether you serve in white supremacy or not, you are still an African. Whether your name is Barack Obama, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, they will turn on you in a heartbeat because you still belong to the race that they consider to be their genetic enemy. And as a result of that, no black person is safe whenever white supremacy is around.
Well, let me break this down, and you're exactly right, because Burl Ellis in DeKalb County, where Dr. King said in 1963, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain, Georgia. Burl Ellis, we have a million-plus population, at least 87% black. So the blacks basically run the city council, and so the CEO swings the vote. And when Burl Ellis was the city councilman, he always would vote with the whites, always. And he finally got in position of power, put them handcuffs on them, like you said. But let me tell you something greater going on in Atlanta. We have an organization that's been on Black Power Radio several times. It's a sister named Vanessa Williams, who's the executive director of the National Conference of Black Mayors. Over 1,000 black mayors, over 600 and about 90, almost 700 is part of the National Conference of Black Mayors, which has been going on about 40 years. They separated from the National Conference of Mayors, which is majority white. Everything was fine and dandy until she took it about 4 years ago international. Once she took it international, it became the International Conference of Black Mayors. Now it has 22,000 black mayors.
Wow.
And just this last May in Atlanta, she brought up partners from the African Union, Colombia, Haiti, Jamaica, Nigeria, Senegal, South Africa, Trinidad, Venezuela, on and on. She had so many Africans in this city, you thought we was in Africa.
Wow.
Now they put a black mayor that she helped become a black mayor in Sacramento, California, named Kelvin Johnson, used to play for the Phoenix Suns.
I remember him.
Who's married to a Korean woman who tried to destroy the educational system.
Oh, man.
And he's a Republican. Because he's a basketball player, we got excited. We wanted the, you know how we are. But anyway, to make a long story short, The Jews at the highest level now are sabotaging the sister because she have took us with Sankofa across the water, and they have found out very quickly, and I'll put the numbers on the air, the conference they had in Atlanta cost $843,000.
Wow.
And the African nations paid at least $700,000+. And Kelvin Johnson became president of the black organization. And the first thing he said he was going to do as president, we're going to stop the international side until we get home straight. As he's saying that Obama is shutting down the White House, can't pay nobody. As he's saying that the white mayors all over the city is trying to go to China and Germany and Ghana and Nigeria. So you know he's trying to sabotage the organization. Now the organization is in court. He's trying to drag the sister through the dirt. We just now about to sue him. We just figured out what happened is two years ago, the white man got behind him and pulled a coup on her. She done been to Libya with Gaddafi. She done been to Uganda. She been with probably about 20 to 30 heads of states of every African country. She's bringing them to America, and I want to send you more information on that and let you talk to the sister. Because
yes,
she's a cold-blooded black woman, and she's standing strong, and she's going to need our help because she is connecting these black mayors with these 22,000 black mayors in Africa, and the white man is angry.
Wow. Wow. Political pan-Africanism. That's a power move. You're right, brother. She's going to need our help. That's a power move right there.
Yeah,
that's
when we get off the air, I want you to definitely talk to her and tell her a story because they attacked her so vicious this year, like you've never seen nobody attack in your life because his sister's so cold-blooded, but we'll talk more about that, but we just talking politics. Brother Shun, do we got another call?
Oh, yes, sir, of course.
Brother, I have to give you back to the people. I got to get in there every once in a while, though.
All right.
Yes, sir.
Area code 757-208. You're on live Black Power Radio. We're talking to Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, Prince of Pan-Africanism. Black Power, your question, comment, come with it.
Black Power, yeah, this is Sister Chuma and VA. I just wanted to kind of go back to what you were saying a minute ago, as far as when you were saying that Europeans are now taking over our music and, you know, they're being initiated and this and that and everything else. But I wanted to add to that fact that not only do I agree with that 100%, but I'm realizing that these Europeans are actually taking time out of their life to get to learn our culture, you know, and those are things that we're not investing in. You know, I just came on a journey from Charlotte because I had thought about studying Europe, and where I was at, it was more Europeans there than it was African. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, that's when I came to the realization that, you know, these Europeans, they're actually investing and taking time out of their life and sacrificing to learn our history and our culture when we're not doing those things, you know. So I think it's important that, you know, we start, you know, putting it in our agenda and making it part of our everyday living to incorporate these lifestyles in our own lifestyle so we know what our own culture is. Because, you know, by the time my grandchildren grow up, they're not going to know the difference between is African culture our culture or is African culture European culture. You know what I'm saying? Because these white folks, they're teaching their children about Yoruba and Dogon and, you know, those things. But you ask our children what is Yoruba or any other type of spiritual practice, and they're like, I don't know, you know. So I think it's important that we need to start making sure that our children are not only learning this information, but we're implementing it in their lifestyle. We're feeding it to them at breakfast. We're feeding it to them at lunch. We're feeding them to them at dinner and snack in between. You know, so that's all
one,
I really want to say.
I totally
to
agree with you, my sister.
Yes,
I agree
right.
Totally. And I would say, just like I said earlier with the conversation that we had about special ed, it's being
right.
done with our consent. I want to be clear. White folks aren't running around stealing African spirituality. We are teaching it to them. These
right.
white men are not running around trying to study how to play the drum. We are teaching them how to do it. So I want to make sure we're clear. Black people are giving rise to the white theft of our spiritual traditions. They ain't stealing this time. We're passing it over for money. You got white folks who go to Africa. They pay top dollar to be initiated so they can come back here and then parade themselves around as some great liberal, okay, because they now been initiated into an African religion and they a child of this god or a child of that god and whatever foolishness. And I'm telling you now, as I say everywhere I go, if we are not careful, we're going to have a situation where in order to practice African religion, they're going to have to get permission from white people. If we keep on letting them into the mystery, if we keep on letting them study voodoo, study Kemet, study Dogon, study Ifa, you keep on doing this, and one day you're going to get so many of them that they're going to decide to incorporate the religion. Incorporate the religion. Now you're going to need a college degree to be a priest of an African religion. You're going to have to pass a test from white people. You're going to have to apply for certification, and you can go to jail if they catch you practicing without a license from white people. That is the direction that African spirituality is headed in, because we got all of these colorblind, multicultural Negroes who fail to recognize that loving your enemy is not going to help your people. And this is where black religion has a lot to do with this, because our religious leaders do a terrible job of teaching us to be loyal to ourselves. They keep on telling us that we're all God's children and we got to love everybody equally. That political confusion has messed us up. And most black folks are running around America talking about, I'm a human being. I am an individual. I don't belong to a race. I am my own person. We're the only people who do that type of foolishness.
You don't hear Chinese people talking about, I'm an individual, I'm not Chinese. They stick to the group. Arabs stick to the group. Japanese stick to the group. European Jews stick to the group. And black people want to be individuals. We cannot win that way. We have to change the way we think, and we must think purely racial and for the benefit of African people. Everything you do, everything you feel, everything you say, every dollar you spend, you have to ask yourself before you spend it, is this dollar being spent in the benefit of my community? Is this woman I'm dating in the benefit of my community? This man I'm about to marry, will this be in the benefit of my community? This job I'm about to accept, is this in the benefit of our community? We have to get our code of honor back. We have lost our code of honor, the code that says I will die before I betray my community. We've lost that code, and we got to get it back, and we better get it back now, because if we don't get that code back, there might not be none of us left around here in order to practice the code.
Yes, sir. And see, I didn't know if you were aware, but in Richmond, they wanted to take our ancestral burial ground and build a baseball stadium. You know, in a hotel and Funland and, you know, amusement parks.
Well, they did that here in Philadelphia, too. They
right.
Were digging, they was building a highway, and they found a grave of our ancestors going back to slavery. And what they did was they made them pack up. They had to pack, they had to bring up the remains of the ancestors, and they were reinterred at a black-owned cemetery right outside of Philadelphia. So they did have to move the graves, but they were respectfully reinterned at another location. They don't have the respect for our ancestors. They don't even have respect for the living. So you know they don't have respect for the dead.
But you know what? And I'm going to go ahead and end with this, but you're right, because even in trying to make sure that we, you know, because we're fighting against it, but we have more Europeans out there fighting to keep our burial sacred ground sacred than we have our own. You know, and it's hard to get out there and move people and like, you know, these are your ancestors. Like, all of us have relatives there. You know what I'm saying? That's the way to look at it. All of us have great-great aunts, great-great uncles, great-great-great grandmothers or whatever else out there, buried there. And it's just like, whatever. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, I just hope we get to the point that we can wake up and understand the importance that if we don't get it together, they are slowly but surely erasing us, erasing our history, you know what I'm saying, and just trying to get, you know, they just going to get rid of us as they will if we don't make a difference.
I totally agree with you, sister. That's why we have to try to organize the adults and re-educate the children, but we must never give up. It's going to be tough. It's going to be hard. It may not happen in your lifetime. It may not happen in my lifetime, but we have to keep on pushing. If we truly believe, that we have as much right to this earth as anybody else. We cannot give up the fight. We must keep it going and pass it off to the next generation. It's not a problem that we die. It's not a problem that we go to jail. That's not the problem. The problem is that after we die, after we go to jail, we have to wait 10, 20, 30, 40 years for another replacement. You see, that's the problem. When Brother Hashim Nzinga is called back by his ancestors and when Dr. Umar Johnson is called back by my ancestors, how long do we wait before another brother or sister steps up? That's the problem. Dr. King was murdered in 68. You haven't had an integrationist of his caliber since. Mr. Garvey died in 1940. You haven't had anyone of that caliber since. So the problem ain't that you die. Mr. Garvey said we got to die. That's going to happen. Soldiers are going to die in war. But the problem with black people is we don't have any replacements. We sit around waiting for leaders to find us. Nobody gets out of oppression waiting for leaders to find them. You have to raise the leaders. You have to groom them. You have to put them through the rite of passage. The leaders that we want are not going to find us. We have to make them. You don't see European Jews looking for leaders. They make them. Anglo-Saxons don't look for leaders. Chinese, Japanese, East Indians, Arabs. You don't hear nobody talking about we looking for leaders. They make the leaders. They build them. They educate them. They groom them. We have to do the same thing. Stop waiting for the leader to find you and start making the leaders so we have a continuous, uninterrupted change of black advocacy and guidance. That's the leader. We have to make them. Stop praying for them and start building them.
Okay, I thank you, and I definitely have to apologize to you. I did miss you when you came to Norfolk a couple of weekends ago.
I'll be back again soon.
Definitely,
no problem, Queen.
All right, Black Power.
All right,
Let me say this, Brother Sean, right quick. Most ridiculous thing in how our big brother is putting this whole piece of the puzzle together is he said Dr. King, Marcus Garvey, look how long it's taken to even think about somebody who we look at on that level. Both of them was taken down by a homosexual named Jager Hoover.
Right.
We let a white man who's screwing another white man walking a poodle down the street on Philadelphia, Pennsylvania Avenue, take out half the black nation. But we'll kill each other over a tennis shoe. This man took out Malcolm, Garvey, made his name off of Garvey, Dr. King. This man had the audacity. And the European is mad at us. But this white man had the audacity to say that Dr. King was the most dangerous man in America, and you know how he viciously attacked Fred Hampton and Mark Clark and little Bobby Huff. This man took out so many giants, and they mad at us because we teach them our own history and we hadn't retaliated and we hadn't stood up and we got FBI headquarters naming themselves after Dr. King. This is a tragedy that we let a name. Jews wouldn't do it. No other race wouldn't let you kill their leader. And the 1999, which we had on our show a couple of weeks ago, proved in the 1999 civil case that the FBI, the United States, was behind the killing, and everybody knows it. But we just say, yeah, we found out, but we still don't do nothing about it. We still don't punish nobody. Jews catch you, 92 years old, your ass going to jail.
You're giving
up that wealth.
In fact, Brother Hashim, you can compare the Nazi tribunal for the European Jews, the victims of the European Jewish Holocaust, you can compare that with the apartheid tribunals in South Africa. Look at how they handled the criminals. If you are a Nazi, like you said, you could be 100 years old on your deathbed. You're going to jail, or you're going to get the death sentence for your role in the extermination of European Jews. But in South Africa, you could have been guilty of killing, raping, but all you had to do was admit your role, and you go free. Who in the hell has ever heard of a human rights tribunal where the perpetrator, the oppressor, only had to admit what they did, and they would be given a clean bill of health? I have never seen something so ridiculous in my life as the South African Tribunal for Apartheid. They let all them Europeans go free after all the death and destruction they caused on our brothers and sisters down in South Africa, and all they had to do was admit what they did. All they had to do was give a confession, and they walk free.
They tried to.
Do you really think the Jews would have stood by and let the Nazis give a confession in order to go free?
And, brother, they tried to mock our leader, Dr. Khalid Muhammad, as some madman because he said he would give them 24 hours to get out of town, and if they wasn't out of town, he would kill the cripple, kill the crazy. And when he said kill him, he would go back to the grave and dig him up and kill him again. He said if you didn't have enough strength to dig the grave, I'd put your gun in and shoot him again. Everybody gets angry at a black man when a black man say he's going to stand for his baby, stand for his woman, stand for his land, stand for his freedom, stand for equality. And the beast who called it, Paul Revere didn't say the nigga was coming. He said the British was coming.
That's right.
And he was British, running from the British.
That's right.
The British would kill and fight over land, over his babies. The Boston Tea Party wasn't drinking tea and putting sugar cubes in the teacup. They were fighting for land. And then on top of all that, brother, you get deep into the psychology of that. The Jews in the 1940s in the Hitler situation was really a miracle and remarkable the Jews, Hitler didn't mean to put the Jews in the gas chambers. What happened is the world war was closing in on him, and out of being desperate, he started to kill them. But he was going to work them to death. He was going to work them in slave camps. The Jews, if they were treated like the African in America, no world war, no France, no British, nobody came to our rescue. We was here 400 and some years of slavery. The Jews' slavery stopped in 6 years, really in 4 years. Their slavery was over. The whole world, including black soldiers, went and shut Hitler down. And out of being desperate, Hitler started putting them in gas chambers. He would have never put them in gas chambers. He would have worked them as slaves, and they would have worked as slaves like us over here 300, 400, 500 years. But all of a sudden, this world, this global society, had a sense of humanity and got together and stopped it in its tracks, and the damn Jews ought to be glad about it, and they get over there and boast in Israel like everybody ought to cry for them. We didn't only cry for you. We died for you and saved your ass, and then you give
That's
us
right.
this in return. Shut the hell up.
That's right.
Brother Sean.
Yes, sir. Still here.
Man, it's just, brother, you know, and what makes me mad, doctor and professor, and I got to keep calling you that because you earned that, doctor, our great science of Kwanzaa, brother Karenga, told me you when a black man get his doctorate and he's a professor, you make sure you respect him with that because we got to earn ours. But when we earn that letter, and we write our writings and we speak, this man just can't get right. Like in the movie Life, he can't get right, man. He don't respect nothing we do. And then what's so cold-blooded is what you teaching. Timbuktu is in Africa. Civilization started in Africa. Education started in Africa. We damn fools for waiting on him to accept what we have to teach him to accept. We ain't got time to teach him to accept it. We too damn busy trying to teach us to accept who we are.
That's right. I'm totally with you on that, my brother.
If that ain't the crazy damn thing this world has to face, and like you said, brother, you are not going to find a Chinese living next door to no black man. You're not going to find no brothers and sisters from India living next door to the black man. You're not going to find nobody from Hong Kong or China or Japan living next door to the black man. But you will find them coming in at 8 o'clock in the morning and opening their little donut shops and their little stores and their little liquor stores and take all your money. But where do they live?
Got some other callers, right?
Brother Sean?
Yes, sir. Got some more callers here. Eric Cole.
Brother Umar, we're only gonna keep you. I just want to show you how to, man, I mean, this ain't respect keeping you to midnight, but we got 12 minutes, and we're going to let you hopefully get some sleep.
No problem.
Okay.
816-325. You're on live. This is Black Power Radio talking to Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Come with your question. Welcome, Black Power.
All right, Black Power. This is Tracy again. I got another question, Dr. Johnson. I'm going to tell you something that's been driving me crazy for a long time. I've noticed within the last 5 or maybe 6 years, white people have been saying, oh, we're all from Africa, and then, you know, we're all humans. And I'm like, you mean all this time you said we were inferior, now you're trying to latch on to us. Now, I was wondering, is that part of the plan to go back into Africa and confuse us, or what do you think that's all about?
Oh, yes, indeed. Remember, the number one weapon of an oppressor is the mind of the oppressed, to confuse. When you confuse people, people don't act. A confused people don't move. A confused people sits around and waits until somebody gives them clarity about what to do, and then they move forward. See, the white man is absolutely certain and crystal clear on his agenda, but it benefits him to keep his oppressed victim confused. So he's constantly sending us mixed messages, so we don't know what to do. One day we get treated good. The next day, Trayvon gets murdered. One day, Obama gets elected. The next day, you know, you have a major snowstorm somewhere where they didn't help the black folks come out of the stuff. So you get confused because
something good happens and then something bad happens, and so you don't know what to do. On one hand, you got the revolutionary community saying white people don't care about us. On the other hand, you got preachers and bourgeois saying white people do care about us. So confusion. Confusion is a very effective weapon, especially when you're trying to get rid of somebody. You make them think that you're on their side when you're not. This whole thing about white people being from Africa is all about them trying to confuse us as it relates to race in this world and in this country. If they can get us to think that they are also from Africa, then we look like we family. That also opens up an opportunity for them to exploit Africa, because if we're all from Africa, that means they have just as much right to the resources of Africa, too. If we're all from Africa, that means we can't get mad at white people for going into Africa and stealing the resources, because they African, too. So you always want to blur the identity between the oppressor and the oppressed, because that makes the oppressed think that the oppressor and them are one and the same, and nothing could be further from the truth. That's exactly why they're pushing this global citizen movement. I don't know if you heard about that, where they want everybody to identify as a global citizen. So now you don't have nations anymore. You have global citizenship, which basically says that we're all citizens of everywhere. Why is that being done? To make everybody feel that they have just as much right to come into Africa and steal as everybody else does. Total nonsense, total confusion. We are African. They are not. We must never forget that they're not, just like they never, ever, ever forget for a single second in time that you are not white.
That's right, black power. We move forward. So thank you so much for that question. You got me fired up here. Over here. Next call, Eric, call is 770-334-770-334. You're online, Black Power Radio, with Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Go ahead with your question, your comment. Welcome, Black Power.
Black Power, comrades. Black Power. I want to give a Black Power salute first to Dr. Umar Johnson, brother. It's always an honor to be able to speak with you, King. I'm still showing these brothers and sisters out here in the streets of Atlanta Hidden Colors 1 and 2, because the teachers that you dropped on there, comrade, are invaluable. And the question I have for you is somewhat really what you and the chairman, Hashim Azinga, salute Black Power, sir, and what you were just going into, which is the systematic destruction of black intelligence. I think that's very important. My question to you, Dr. Umar, is what is your suggestion to the black youth for us to bring back the prestige of black intelligence? Because I keep hearing you and Brother Hashim bring up how the bourgeoisie, particularly the black bourgeoisie, is used to distort or disrupt consciousness. You know, if we understand theory, just black intellectual revolutionaries, then we understand how consciousness grows and spirals, brothers and sisters. Sometimes it's almost communal and pro-people, and sometimes it's very military, police state, destructive and violent. So our people are, like you said, Dr. Johnson, very confused. And out here in Atlanta, we're working consciously to redefine the consciousness, re-deliver the revolutionary theory to the people where we rebuild a revolutionary culture, sir. But we have the black bourgeoisie, the Negro peons, as we went into last week on Black Power Radio, who continue to distort, disrupt, destroy intellectually our people and our youth. We are very, very, very adamant on rebuilding the prestige of the black intelligentsia, not the black bourgeoisie. I think we have to define that for our people so they can understand who our enemies are, black, white, blue, or purple, brother. So my question to you, King, before we get off of Black Power Radio tonight, is what is your suggestion to the youth, the urban minds that have the ability to deliver the information but still have to combat these bootlegs, bourgeoisie, Negro peons standing in our way, our age generation, elder and beyond, said Black Power.
Well said, Queen. I think, as I was saying earlier, one of the biggest issues with the black bourgeoisie is that they're protected by black people. Every bourgeois has an entourage in the community who protects them. There are people in the community, well-meaning people too, who are going to protect Al Sharpton no matter what from being accountable. They're going to protect Jesse Jackson no matter what from being accountable. They're going to protect Henry Louis Gates no matter what from being accountable. And so we have to look at ourselves and how we allow them to operate so freely as they do. So the biggest barrier to holding them accountable is the fact that they have protection agents in all the communities who actually think that they're doing a good job for the people. The average follower of Al Sharpton thinks he's a loyalist to African people. The average follower of Henry Louis Gates thinks that his scholarship is to the benefit of African people. So you have to look at how the lack of political education, the lack of the ability to analyze your situation, we got to improve our critical thinking skills. One of our issues is that we don't critically analyze things correctly and we don't do them thoroughly. And I think one of the benefits to a good education for our children is one that teaches them how to constructively critique every and anything they see, they hear, or that they read. It's going to be very important because in order for our people to see these sellouts for who they are, they're going to have to be educated into how to properly analyze and evaluate black leadership. But let me also say this. Many black people would voluntarily replace Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson if they were given the right money to do so. There's a million bourgeois just waiting for the opportunity. Most black parents raise their children to be bourgeoisies. Most black parents raise their kids to get a good education, get out the neighborhood. Don't you look out for no black people. Just worry about yourself because black people got problems. I mean, look at how we raise our kids. The average black child is raised by his parents to be a bourgeoisie. So I don't want to personalize the bourgeois. I want to processize the bourgeois so we understand this bourgeois factory is the process that the black community is also guilty of creating because we don't expose, we don't hold accountable, and then we socialize our kids to be Jesse Jackson. We socialize our kids to be an Al Sharpton. So we have to deal with the fact, the harsh fact, that the average black person in America does not have a problem with white supremacy. They only have a problem with the way white supremacy treats them. And if white supremacy was willing to let them participate in the extermination of African people, they would willingly do it if they're going to get paid for it. You've seen how proud black people are when they put on police uniform, how proud they are when they put on a government uniform, how proud they are when they have on a Marine Corps uniform or a Army uniform. Black people are proud when they put on those white uniforms. So we're not talking about a few bourgeoisies running around. I mean, we are, but I also want us to recognize that when Jesse Jackson leaves, there'll be another. When Al Sharpton leaves, there'll be another. When Barack Obama leaves, there'll be another. So it ain't so much the personality. It's the process that allows them to manifest in the first place. And the only way we're going to stop that process is by coming up with a system that holds our leaders accountable for the things that they do in our community.
Yes, thank you for that beautiful analysis. You just really concurred with everything that we believe and are implementing out here. So, comrades, I want to salute y'all. It's a blessing to be on Black Power Radio. This is y'all Queen Commander Nadia Sajid-Shakur, National Spokeswoman of New Black Panther Party, author Cold Soul Sherry, sir. It's a salute and honor to once again talk to you. Black Power Salutes, National Chairman Hashim Mzinga. Black Power Salutes, National Chief of Staff Sean Kwali, sir. Salute to you, brother Dr. Umar Johnson. Peace and blessings.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Salute, return. Doctor, we've got a couple more questions. You got time? What are we looking like?
Yeah, we can take a few more.
Yeah, we got a. What is going to cut off in 2 minutes, right, Sean?
Oh, yeah. Okay, we got a little more than that. We got a little more time.
No, go ahead, roll. I don't want to disrespect somebody. It might be the question. I mean, I was one of those guys hanging onto that phone, brother, doctor. So let it roll.
All right, so we'll take these last couple of calls here. We'll respect Dr. Umar's time. I appreciate you hanging in there.
We ain't respecting him, none. No, we not.
It's all good.
Yes, sir.
Every code 774-360. Every code 774-360. You're on live on Black Power Radio, talking here with Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, your host. Welcome to the broadcast. Your question, please. Come on with it, Black Power.
Black Power, this is Brother Clark calling from Boston.
All right, Black Power.
Black Power, when I had a question for Dr. Umar, I just wanted to know what can I do to re-Africanize myself, and I also have another question on what is, you know, is there a ritual into becoming a man? Because I just turned 18 and I don't really feel that.
Well, without question, it's definitely a ritual as it relates to becoming a man. All coaches have them, blue, black, purple. We have it too. We have the first ones and the best ones, rites of passage. But that's something that the men in the community really have to put together so we can start taking young brothers through it, such as yourself. Many of us came to manhood without going through a rite of passage. But what we have to do is go back and get those cultural models from the motherland, and we have to put systems in place so that we can take you and other brothers through that whole rite of passage, because I think one of the biggest missing components in our transition from childhood to adulthood is that we don't have the rites of passage processes in place. The elements are out there. We just have to construct them and put them together. So you have some rites of passage in some places, but you don't have them everywhere for everybody. And that's something that we have to do. As it relates to re-Africanizing yourself, one of the things that makes it so difficult for a person to re-Africanize themselves by themselves is that you lose that objective assessment that comes from someone else helping you go through that process. It's like when somebody's in therapy, the therapist helps you understand that your assessment of yourself isn't totally correct. See, our ego plays games on us and makes us think we're doing a lot better than we're actually doing in certain areas. And this is why a lot of black people can still hold themselves to be conscious, even though they engage in a lot of unconscious behavior, because the ego doesn't like to be held accountable. But I think some of the things that you can do right now as it relates to re-Africanizing yourself, number one, you got to go to Africa. There's no way to re-Africanize yourself without going to Africa and then visiting some traditional African villages so you can learn the culture firsthand. For me, one of the best things that helped me to re-Africanize, and I'm still in that process, it's a lifetime thing. I'm by no means a done, not by far. But when I went to Africa for the first time in 2005, it showed me how much of a European I still was, despite my consciousness. I saw firsthand that I was still a Negro, and I needed to see that, because if I didn't see that, I would have stopped growing and I would have stopped developing. So you're going to have to go to Africa. You might consider going with us this July. You also have to read. Now, reading isn't going to uncondition your subconscious, but it is going to provide you with some much-needed relevant information. The toughest part of re-Africanization, the toughest part of any type of a treatment program, is your ability to objectively evaluate your progress. That means your ability to tell yourself that you're doing better or you're doing worse. Your ability to catch yourself in every instance that you're acting like a European. That could be a very difficult thing to do because, number one, the ego doesn't want to do it, and most of us don't have the willpower to keep it up over an entire lifetime. So it is a process, young brother, but I know you and I, we spoke a lot, Brother Clark, and I know you've been calling me. And a lot of your calls I've been missing, brother, because I'm always flying and I'm always in a meeting or testing kids or what have you. But we definitely will connect within the next couple of days, my brother. And I would, you know, love to help you any way I can in that process. So you and I will definitely be talking soon.
All right, brother. That's all I needed to know. Thank you so much. I appreciate the help you're doing for the community globally and everything. Black power.
Black power.
Like power, no doubt about it. Okay, we'll make this the last call of the night. With that respect, Dr. Umar Tahiri, we appreciate it. Area code 203-952. You're on live with Black Power Radio. It's Sean Saddam Kwali talking to Umar. Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Here was your question to comment, please. Welcome to Black Power.
Yes, Black Power. This is Panther calling from Connecticut. And my question to Dr. Umar is, it's kind of two, but I'm thinking that in Zimbabwe with President Mugabe, don't you think that we should be having that even the blacks in the diaspora, we need to be rallying around him? And we need to have something here, I think, in the United States that unites us with them to let them know that, you know, if he's the one person in Africa who was mad enough to take back the land, take the resources, and at least put that foot forward to try to make it right for us. I just don't see where enough people are standing up for him, making a voice be known. I think everybody should be behind him and standing up and make it known, so then the other leaders in Africa can feel to do the same thing and know that at least we are behind them, and to help our connection with Africa as well. Because and then the main question I wanted to ask, hope I'm not sounding so confusing, but for us to get to start to develop a community again, don't you think that maybe if we have the Black Panther Party, maybe everyone needs to join the Black Panther Party movement again, where we can at least all be on the same page, state by state, and then we could maybe start to move together? Because the main problem I see is, like, if I'm ready to move and act upon things, but then how am I getting the community involved? And there's no organization, the NAACP, all these other groups aren't doing anything. They're not even for the benefit of what's really going on. They don't even talk about the real issues. So I don't know. I think, number one, we all need to be standing behind and make our voices known for Mugabe, if he's willing just to let the other African countries know that we do stand. We love what you're doing. Then please, can everybody else think the same way? And maybe we can get something done here. And then for us to, you know, get together as community here, because we have no communities no more. And that's the problem, that there are soldiers who are ready to fight, but we're so far apart we don't even know who each other are in our own community.
Well said, Queen. Well, number one, and I agree with you 100%, and I would just add to your comments in support, communities are built around institutions, town hall, school, bank, spiritual institutions, economic systems. You got to have infrastructure. There is no such thing as a community without an infrastructure. That's a ghetto. If we're going to build communities, we have to be able to fulfill the needs of the people. Once you're able to fill people's needs, once you're able to provide for the things that are basic necessities for all humans, you get their attention. And then when you get their attention, you will be able to command their loyalty, their allegiance, and you will be able to dictate appropriate behavior. And why? Because you're fulfilling needs. When you're able to give out jobs, you can dictate behavior. When you're able to feed people, clothe people, employ people, you will be able to dictate their behavior. So we have to understand that one of the reasons that it's so difficult to get Black people's attention and so difficult to control the behavior of our people is because their needs are being provided for by their enemy. So I am not going to listen to nothing the Black conscious community has to say until the Black conscious community can start giving me a job, until they can help me with my children. If we don't provide for the needs of people, we'll never help them. Take me, for example. I believe one of the reasons why I get so much love and support when I travel the world, okay, is because I'm able to help. You know, if somebody's having issues with their children, Dr. Umar can actually help you eliminate the problem immediately. And so people see that I have something that they can use that can help them immediately. That's where my usefulness comes in. Okay? Now I got to get them over to Pan-Africanism. That's going to take some work. But they see the basic usefulness in me being able to help them fight to protect their children. And so I become relevant. We in the conscious community have to become relevant. Once you start providing for the needs of the people, you will not have to beg them to do anything. They will do it willingly because they don't want to lose the support or the service that you provide them. If you want people to be loyal, you just can't hope for it. You have to engineer their loyalty.
Yes, I agree, because it is so difficult, and it's You just don't know what to do. And but what do you feel about people rallying around in the diaspora for Zimbabwe?
Oh, I'm totally in support of that. And not only Zimbabwe, you know, Uganda with the situation they got with President Obama, okay, in the Congo with the strife that's there because of the conflicts that are manipulated by the multinational corporations and mineral companies. So without question, we have to have a Pan-African program that supports all of our people in the continent, whatever they're dealing with. Brother Mugabe needs our support, as do other places. Ethiopia, one of the poorest countries in the world, cradle of civilization, we have to support them as well. So there's so much work that we have to do in Africa. But what I want people to understand is that by giving to Africa, you're not taking away from yourself. You're giving to yourself. The better Africa is, the more she's able to look out for the rest of us. As I said earlier, you can only rise as great as your national homeland. Africa is our homeland, whether we want to act like it or not. Everybody knows that, including white people. So we could keep on living this historical amnesia, acting like we don't have any connection to Africa. But when we walk down the street, they don't see American citizens. When a black person walks down the street, they are not an American citizen. They are an African. So we got to stop running from our heritage and start running to our heritage, because I believe our salvation is in our Africanity.
All right. Thank you so much, caller. Yes, sir, Dr. Umar, in the interest of time, we want you to go ahead and make your final statement here and give out your information, your website, the numbers. You know how to do it. Go ahead, black man.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. First, I want to thank you, National Chairman Minister Hashim Nzinga, for having me on tonight, along with the rest of the new Black Panther family. I always enjoy it when I come on Black Panther Power Radio. A shout-out to King Samir Shabazz, Brother Jerry, my Panthers down in Texas, Brother Asar, and all the other brothers who provide security for me when I come down there. My Panthers over in Los Angeles. My mind is drawing a blank. I can't remember all my Panther brothers' names, but from around the country, Chicago, so forth and so on, always volunteering to do security for the good brother. Also, I got to shout out my Nation of Islam brothers who always do security for me as well. I was with one of the good brothers, TC, last night in Greensboro, who did security for me down there. So I can't thank the new Black Panther Party enough and the Nation of Islam enough for always looking out for the best interest of Dr. Umar, my physical well-being, as I travel the world. Brothers and sisters, you can get with me at drumarjohnson.com, drumarjohnson.com. You can email me at drumarjohnson@yahoo.com. Facebook, you can follow me at Dr. Umar Ifatunde. That's Dr. Umar, Ifatunde, Ifatunde on Facebook. That's the only Facebook page that I control, Dr. Umar Ifatunde. Twitter, WhatsApp and Instagram, Dr. Umar Johnson. Phone number, 215-989-9858. Please consider going to Ghana with me this summer, July 14th through the 24th. Information should be up on my Facebook real soon. The shockumentary will be coming out this summer. If anybody has a testimonial for which they need to be interviewed to be included in this groundbreaking movie, documentary on the war against our young men, please text me your name, your city, and the word shockumentary. So if I was texting myself, it would be Umar Johnson, North Philadelphia, shockumentary. Also, we'll be in Toronto, Canada, first week in August for the first Pan-African Conference. During the Carabana, one of the largest African festivals in the world, you do not want to miss that. And, of course, London, England, I'll be playing Marcus Garvey in a stage play during Garvey Week to commemorate 100 years of Garvey and Garveyism, 1914 to 2014. If you're interested in helping me organize an independent Black Parent Association in your city, if you want to help Dr. Umar form a chapter of the National Independent Black Parent Association, please send me an email at drumarjohnson.com so we can go ahead and schedule that and get this thing moving, brothers and sisters. San Diego, California, I will see you Friday and Saturday. Ferris State University, Big Rapids, Michigan, I will see you on Tuesday next weekend. I will see Chicago, Milwaukee next Sunday, Detroit the last weekend of Black History Month, and then I'll start the month off of March, March 2nd and 3rd, the hometown of Michael Jackson, Gary, Indiana, March 7th and 8th, Tennessee. I'll be down at Lemoyne Owen College in Memphis, Tennessee. Looking forward to that. South America, the Republic of Suriname, March 11th through the 18th, and the list goes on. If anyone wants to know when Dr. Umar is coming to your town, all you have to do is send me a text message or email or Facebook or tweet, and I'll let you know when I'm coming close. But again,
Minister Hashim Nzinga, new Black Panther Party hat goes off to you, brother, for the work that you're doing. Dr. Umar is here whenever you need me. And I thank you so much for this interview.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We thank you, Brother Chapman. Any closing words, sir?
Hold on. Yes, sir. Let me say this. Dr. Johnson, it's been like family members in the living room. You know, it used to be real complex to have these kind of conversations. We was the spook who sat by the door when we talk like this. It just it's good that God finally has opened our eyes and made us get out of the closet and get out of the back rooms and come on the rooftop and tell the truth like every other man in the world. The meaning of man is being a man, and brother, I'm so glad that I was on this show for 4 hours tonight with a man. Your God and your ancestors are happy.
Thank you, my brother. Thank you so much for those words.
Brother Sean, it's on you. All right. Yes, sir. Dr. Umar, thank you so much. Get you some rest, sir. God willing, see you in the whirlwind. The chairman, thank you so much, sir. Get you some rest. God willing, we'll see you in the whirlwind. Brothers and sisters, you've been listening to Black Power Radio with our special guest, Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Make sure that you email him at umarjohnson@yahoo.com or go to his website and his webpage. I believe it's umarjohnson.com, and support his movement and support his work. And we support his work and support his movement and thank him for his time and his tireless effort that he is putting across the country on behalf of Pan-Africanism and on behalf of the liberation of our people. And we know that our general, the Honorable Dr. Khaled Abdul Muhammad, will be very proud and supportive, and so are we. And again, this is Black Power Radio, and for those of you who would like to organize a chapter, as my sister was saying, of the Black Panther Party and build that Black Power movement and build that self-determination and Black cooperative economics and all of that good stuff that we do, email us at newblackpantherheadquarters@gmail.com. One more time, that's newblackpantherheadquarters@gmail.com. Or you can reach us by phone at area code 347-903-0886. Again, that's 347-903-0886. The website is newblackpanther.com. We thank you so much for listening, and we are hopeful that you have enjoyed yourself and that you will tune in with us for more future broadcasts of Black Power Radio. We do this every Monday night, beginning at 8 p.m. Eastern. Lock us into your phone stations. Lock us into your radio dial. It's Black Power for Black People. It's all power to the people. And remember this, if Black people are not free, then really there's nobody that's free. Black Power.
The various